Hello and welcome to our Food Principles module, and this is our final real big content piece on additional diets. These are those pieces that didn't quite make the cut to get their own private presentation on, and we're just going to go through a couple of them that you might have heard of, that you might have experienced, and see how they fit into the picture of the work that you're doing with your clients. So before we get started, I'd just like to reinforce each time that this presentation is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's not medical advice. And when you present these sorts of things to your clients, unless you're in a patient-doctor situation where diagnosis and treatments are valid words, then you want to make sure that you're within the scope of whatever your licensure is and talking about the fact that this is education and information to help them make informed choices about their own health care. And especially if they're on any medications or under the care of a doctor, just make sure that you advise them to check in with their doctor to make sure that nothing that you educated them about is in conflict with what they're doing. So let's just jump right in with our new USDA dietary guidelines, right? There's nothing new under the sun, is there? Avoid fatty meats, get daily exercise, eat your veggies. Those are the things we talk to people about, yet it becomes really complicated, doesn't it, when we have so many different diet plans that they've read about, that they've experimented with, and for them to try, and not necessarily all of them are in their best interest. And that's what the purpose of this whole module was about. So today we're going to go take a look at the blood type diet. Lots of people have experimented with this diet. Lots of people have asked about this diet. It's based on a book called Eat Right for Your Type by Dr. D'Adamo, Peter D'Adamo. He also has the Live Right for Your Type and Eat Right for Your Baby. He's a naturopathic doctor, studied glycobiology, adjunct clinical professor at Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine in Tempe and in National College in Portland. So he says, and I totally agree, we all agree, right? That's why we're doing this whole module, is a one-size-fits-all approach to nutrition doesn't work. We teach that we have to take everything into an account. His particular diet is taking into account the influence of their blood type on the way that they should eat. And he connects it with lectins, which are particular chemical markers that plants put out, and also to the FUT2, and we'll go into a little bit about the FUT2 SNP, which has to do with secreting your blood type into your mucus secretions in your body. What he concluded in his research was that blood type is the key that unlocks the door to the mysteries of health, disease, longevity, physical vitality, and emotional strength. Okay, so again, his principles, great, right? Customize, but then it narrows it down to one particular area, like everybody chooses what they eat based on their blood type. And we know by studying what we studied in this module that there's more to it. And that this is a key component, perhaps, and it should be considered, but there's more. So what's the theory? It's that the blood type might predict your susceptibility for certain diseases, and we certainly see that played out, that certain types have more of a tendency to certain diseases and even personality types, that they respond differently to stress, that the antigens are not just in your blood, that they're actually markers in different parts of the body, and your gut bacteria can be related to your blood type. Lectins that are incompatible with your blood type will target an organ or body system like the liver, the kidneys, the gut, the stomach, and anywhere else, joints. So lectins in those foods, the idea is that the foods present with these lectins and they are incompatible with our blood type antigens. FUT2 is a SNP, and it's a SNP that there's multiple variations on. And what it does is it determines whether you tend to be a secretor or a non-secretor. Basically, about 80% of the population are secretors and 20% are non-secretors. And what that means is that you actually secrete these blood type antigens into mucous membranes, so into the sinus cavities, into the vagina, into the gut, into the respiratory system. So his theory is that we should generally, in healthy people, shoot for about 80% compliance with the blood type diet. So it's not the type of diet where this is disallowed, this is allowed, this is a permanent sentence for the rest of your life. Like it might be with a food allergy that's inborn, genetically transmitted, and it's not going to go away. So let's look at blood types just as a review, okay? So what we have is we have three different blood types that we look at, A, B, and O. And it's basically, there's different antigens that are expressed based on the blood type. So the A is from mom and dad. So this is a chart, like remember back in high school when we studied Mendelian genetics and we made these charts like blue eyes, black eyes, which is dominant, which is recessive, and what do we end up with? So if you have one parent with an A and one parent with an A, the only way the kid can come out is an AA. If you have one parent with a B and one parent with an A, you're going to get an AB. If you have an A and an O, you're going to get an AO, which is really expressing as an A. So the end resultant blood type in each of these are A, AB, and A. If we have a B, we have AB, which is the same as the opposite one. We have BB, we have a B. And if we have BO, we have a B. Okay? So with the O's, if you get an O from one parent and an A from another parent, then what you're going to have is an A or a BO, which is going to be an A or a B, or OO, which is the true O type blood. And what this boils down to is that if you have A blood and you try to inject yourself with somebody's blood who has B, your body has antibodies against the B. So that's going to result in massive trauma to your body. So this other chart on the right-hand side is a list of the different types of blood type. Now, we can throw a monkey wrench into this and we can look at Rh factor. And that's another type of antigen in the blood, Rh positive or Rh negative. Most people are Rh positive. Some of us, me included, are Rh negative. So if you know that you have a type A blood, it's generally assumed when you say you have a type A blood that you have A positive. So you have that the positive for the Rh factor. And if you were to try to give me blood and I was a type A, but I was a type A negative, I would have a massive rejection reaction. And that's a complication that often happens in pregnancy when we have an Rh positive and negative parents getting together and producing a baby. If the baby ends up an Rh negative, then the mom's blood can actually be attacking baby's blood. And those are situations where babies in the olden days just died in utero. And in these days, they actually can do transfusions in utero. And they can preempt this by giving antibodies beforehand so that there's a preparation for it. So the baby does not die because of this reaction. So it's a serious situation when we try to give transfusions of crossed blood types. So this just shows on the right-hand side the types of donors that you can get. And I don't mean to go into too much detail about this, but it's interesting stuff, and it's stuff that you probably ought to know, especially if you're interested in this type of a diet and talking to people about it. So if you've got somebody who's an AB plus or minus, and you got somebody who has an O minus, they are called the universal donor. That first column is O minus. They can give blood to everyone. An O positive person can only give blood to anybody else that has a positive. So they can give it to AB, A, or B, or O. A B negative can give to anybody who's an AB or an AB positive or negative or a B. So I happen to be a B negative. So I can donate to more people than my counterpart who has the Rh plus. But I can only get from very few people. I can only receive blood from someone who's either an O negative or a B negative. So there's only two blood types out of the eight of them, right, that I can get blood from. So it's great to be a negative, Rh negative, because you're a great donor, but you're not a great receiver. I wonder if that's a metaphor for my life. Okay, so then when we go to A negative, right, A negative can give to AB or A in negative, but not to the Bs or the Os. And then the same thing with A positive, you're limited to just the two that you can give to, and the same thing with B. And AB is very limited. AB is actually, somebody is an AB negative, they have very few people that they can get blood from, because it's very, very specific, right? It really narrows it down. So that's an overview of the blood type, just to give you an idea of what we're dealing with. And the thing is that you've got these markers on your blood cells, and you've got also antibodies in the plasma. So if somebody's in A, they're going to have anti-B antibodies, and they're going to have the A antigen. So if someone donates blood to them, and they're going to attack that blood. Same thing with B. B has anti-A antibodies, but the antigen is B. AB doesn't have any antibodies because it's got to be able to accept both and A and B antigens. And then O has antibodies against both, but no antigens. So O can be donating anywhere because there's no antigens in there. So that's enough of the overview of genetics. Let's look at some of the connections that have been made between blood type and various parts of the body. So certain things with the blood type and microbiome. One thing has to do with adhesion factors, that in the bacteria can actually use different blood type antigens on the cells and in the digestive lining as a way to attach to the cells and tissues. So if somebody's a secretor, meaning they're secreting their blood type antigens into their digestive tract, then certain types of bacteria can adhere to that. That can be good or that can be bad, right? So the good part is like Bifidobacter, which we really want a lot of in the gut. If you're secreting your antigens in there and there's certain type that attract that more, then you're going to be able to build up better colonies. And when we talk a little bit more about the secretors in the FUT2, we'll see that there's a problem with certain people who are non-secretors. And I'm a non-secretor as well. So I've got this B negative and a non-secretor gene. So I've got to really be careful about my gut microbiome. There can be an inappropriate response, like certain bacteria can trigger a bigger response than expected from the immune system because of the blood type. Certain types of energy, some bacteria have a taste preference, if we can call bacteria having a taste preference, for a certain type of blood versus another. And they consume that blood type antigen as a source of energy. So in the case of Bifidus likes to eat blood type antigens. I mean, it just likes to eat them in general and will grow if you're a secretor, but not a secretor. And then molecular mimicry. Like some bacteria make certain markers that are similar to one type or another and gives them an advantage in the body of the person with that blood type. Of course, that can be good or bad. It just depends on the type of bacteria. So what else is blood type related to? Well, there's certain diseases. According to D'Adamo, type O generally has a lower risk for heart disease and a higher risk for stomach ulcers. Type A have a higher risk for microbial infections. Type A women have a higher rate of infertility. Type AB and B have a higher risk of developing pancreatic cancer. Okay, so some of these connections can be made. So what does this have to do with food anyway? Well, let's look at exercise. So according to D'Adamo and according to other researchers, the type O's tend to be really good at intense physical exercise. They're the ones that do aerobics and martial arts and running. Whereas the type A's are our yoga dudes, right? They're also vegetarian when it comes to the food preferences, according to this research. So they're good at yoga, right? Ninja, nice and easy. Tai Chi and those sorts of things. Type B tends to be somewhere in the middle where, you know, walking, hiking, bicycling, swimming. So intense, but not super, super intense exercise. And then the ABs tend to be a combination of A and B, good at cycling, tennis, yoga. So these are just correlations that have been made. Is it set in stone? No. Of course, there's so many other things that play in. But if we're just looking at the impact of blood type on exercise, this can then relate back to the food because these different types of exercise programs are going to require different macronutrient balance as well. What about stress? Well, according to D'Adamo, type A's naturally have higher cortisol, and they produce the most cortisol of all the types in response to stresses. Type B is close to A in the level of cortisols, but they tend to overreact to stress, and they have difficult times recovering from stress, although they deal better with stress than type A's do. type O's tend to be the high, you know, high drivers, right? Our type A personalities overproducing adrenaline. They have more difficult time clearing the adrenaline, and then they have a longer recovery time from stress. So these people get really worked up, and then it's really hard to amp them back down. And then type AB overproduced catecholamine, similar to type O, but they tend to internalize anger and hostility, maybe as opposed to just stewing inside and feeling the stress. So that's how they respond to stress. And, you know, we talk about eating, we talk about stress eating and all that can be related to this as well. So the blood type personalities, well, type O tends to have, they're pleasant, sociable, optimistic, but they can also be vain, dishonest, jealous, and insolent. Again, you know, research based on correlations, this is not science, this is not rocket science, this is not set in stone, not all A's are going to be like this, not all O's, but if we see a correlation and we see a trend. Type A tends to be honest, creative, sensitive, reserved, patient, and responsible, but also finicky, too eager, stubborn, uptight, and conservative. So if you're seeing yourself in any of these, it's almost like reading the horoscopes, right? There is definitely something there, but we don't know really what it is. So type B, positive traits, enthusiastic, enterprising, creative, passionate, strong. And I read that and go, yeah, that's me. Negative traits, selfish, irresponsible, ruthless, unpredictable. I don't think so. So then the ABs, positive, relaxed, calm, rational, sociable, negative, critical, indecisive, thoughtless, and irresponsible. Just thought these would be interesting things for you to take a look at as you look at people coming in and saying, hey, blood type diet. So when we look at ancestry, according to Diadamo, the type A's are more the plant-based eaters. They're more the folks that really do well and thrive on a vegetarian or mostly plant-based diet. The type B's tend to do well on a mixed diet, kind of nomads, wandering, eat whatever's available. The type AB's tend to be more from the sea, like, you know, they do better on lean meats and stuff and fish. And then the type O's are our hunters, our hunter-gatherers, right? And they tend to do well better on a lot of meat. And, you know, when people read this, they just, okay, I get to eat a lot of meat, or okay, I don't get to eat any meat. It's a matter of, like any other diet, testing on yourself and having your clients test on them. So this is what Diadamo came up with in terms of how do you individualize the food for these different people. So we a lot of times see the plate depicted, like how much of your plate should be this. We see pyramids, but we also see plates. So in a type O, you can see that more than half of the plate is meat and about 25% is oil. And just a small amount of fruits and vegetables, like 40%. Whereas type A, we're looking at 70% type A, and then the other parts, a little bit of oil and beans and nuts and soy. Quite frankly, I don't consider oil as a food group. So I'm not a big fan of anybody doing a lot of oil, but there are people who have such a high metabolic rate that you've got to give them some oil to make up for the calories they're burned because they just can't fit that much food. So the type B's, you know, more than 50% on the fruits and vegetables, but meat and dairy, where you don't see the meat and dairy in type A, and then a larger amount of oil. And again, you can't just look at this and say, oh, this person's an A, this person's a B, and this would work well. It's a matter of finding the balance. And if you do find that a person does better on more meats or seafoods than you would have originally thought to give them, then you basically are, you know, it's maybe you look at this as a part of the puzzle, and because it is a part of the puzzle. And then the ABs are more in the fish, seafood, with some oil and fruits and vegetables. So it's an interesting way to look at diet, and it's an interesting way to look at how people work. So where does this all come from? What does this have to do with food? So blood type and lectins. Lectins are proteins. They're found in different foods, and they're like markers. They're abundant, and they're diverse. They have this property called agglutinating, which means they cause things to clot or clump. And that can affect the blood and the digestive tract lining. So you get this clumping of the blood or clumping of the secretions in the digestive tract, making them work less efficiently. Our immune system uses this as super glue for the benefit. So, and our germs, our bugs that come in, use this super glue to their benefit to try to hide from and not be made available to getting wiped out. Lectins used by viruses or bacteria can be blood type specific. And each blood type is supposed to avoid certain lectins. And this is, again, that 80% stick to your thing. So with type O, avoid wheat, soy, peanut, and kidney beans. Type A, lima beans, tomatoes, eggplant, and garbanzo beans. Type B, chicken, corn, soy, and lentils. And type AB, chicken, corn, bell pepper, and fava beans. So how can you use this with people? If you were to read the book, which I did many, many years ago, and I tried to actually do it, because I try to experiment with all these diets, but the list of what I should avoid as a B was so long that it was overwhelming, and so I didn't do it. But this is a much more practical list. Okay, I actually do avoid all of the things on that list. And it's just naturally gravitated towards that just based on how I feel. And you may find that with yourself or with your folks that they're gravitating. But this is a nice overview, a simplification of it to help people stay off of it. Personally, I find that everybody does better without the wheat. And I actually think that in the book, I remember reading that most people were taken off of wheat, which is why I felt like many people got such great results right away. They got off the wheat and the sugar and the dairy. But again, you can look it up. You can, you know, use the book if it's something you want to do. But it's something to consider. And I don't know how many of you have read the book by Gabriel Cousins called Conscious Eating. And in there, he just looks at the whole concept of food and looking at our food as our medicine and personalizing it to how we feel. But not just sitting down and scarfing down food like most people do, as having conversations and just eat. And eating with consciousness. And so looking at the various types of food plans that are out there and sitting with the food and seeing how it makes you feel. And that's a good thing to do with this. So let's talk a little bit about the secretor, non-secretor. The gene is FUT2. And like I said, there's several variations. In fact, I have the positive for this. I have, if you look at my gene report, of all the FUT2s that are reported on some of the reports that I run, I have all of them. I have all of them. All of them are homozygous, red. So I'm a non-secretor big time. I'm not even a partial non-secretor. I'm probably 100% non-secretor. And when I learned this, I realized why I crave probiotic foods. I crave it. My body needs constant reinforcement with probiotics to keep my levels up. Because here's what happens. When you secrete those blood types into your body tissues, into your gut in particular, it can be food for the bifidobacter. So for me, my poor bifidobacter aren't getting fed because I'm not feeding them. So I'm constantly having to reinforce their troops. The FUT2 gene is completely independent of the ABABO, and I'd be negative, but I'm also a non-secretor. I could be a B and I could be a secretor. A non-secretor puts almost none of that blood type into the body fluid. And the average is like about 20% of the U.S. population are non-secretors and 80% of them are secretors. So I'm in that 20%. Secretors have the slowest clotting. Non-secretors have shorter bleeding times because they will clot more quickly. That can be plus and that can be minus. It's a good thing if you're bleeding and you're injured, you're going to stop bleeding more quickly. It's not a good thing if you're eating poorly and you've got clots that form in your arteries and you have a heart attack. Non-secretors have more oral disease and in the cavities because they're not secreting the blood type antigens, which is not keeping the bacterial population under control. And I would say that in my family of origin and me, I had problems with my teeth starting from when I was 8 years old. Now, it could have had a lot to do with the jelly beans and the M&Ms that I ate and the Kool-Aid, but I had more cavities than the rest of my friends, and they were all eating that way too. A secretors have the lowest number of cavities. I know people who just have never had a cavity in their life. Non-secretors have more digestive problems, H. pylori and celiac. And then each blood type can be modified. So the dietary recommendations that he puts out in this blood type diet, you modify it based on your FUT2 status, whether you're a secretor or non-secretor. And I've always had gut issues. From the time I was really small, I had really bad gut issues. So probably explained by my non-secretor status. So that's it for the blood type diet. What I highly recommend that you do is, if it's something of interest, play with it. Start with that little chart of just removing a few of those foods from your people based on their blood type and seeing, because it's an easy thing. If you try to get them to do the full-on diet, they can rebel, and I rebelled, and I'm pretty good at doing stuff. And then see how they do and just really take it for what it is. In Cousin's book, The Conscious Eating, he talked about how he found out, you know, whatever his type was, and there were certain foods he was supposed to avoid. And so he experimented with it, and he did find that if he ate moderate amounts of those foods, he was fine. But if he ate too much of them or larger amounts, he did get symptoms. He felt more groggy. He didn't feel as full energy. So you play with it, and you help your people to play with it. So this is an interesting new diet. It's kind of what I would consider more of a fad diet, but it does have some quote-unquote scientific underpinnings. It's called the If It Fits Your Macros diet. And it's a diet based on the percentage of protein, fat, carbohydrate that you eat based on your particular goals. And basically, it basically does say, so I can eat whatever I want as long as it fits my macros. And I've seen that. I actually signed up for this guy's website and was watching the emails coming out. And he's talking about, sure, you don't have to give up pizza and chocolate cake and ice cream and candy. Why should you have to give it up? As long as you do the right macro balancing. So let's take a look at this briefly, and it, you know, you can use it with a grain of salt. So it's considered flexible diet. It's considered the Pop-Tart diet. It's been called that because, yeah, you can eat Pop-Tarts as long as you make sure that you get your right macros in. So this is one of those things that someone created it, and they decided that this was a good thing to do. They experimented with it. It worked for them. They got ripped on this diet, and so they figured it would work for everybody. So the goal is to hit your macro percentages daily. So how much protein, how much carbohydrate, and how much fat. And quite frankly, it makes it sound easy, but that those are hard things to do because you have to be weighing and measuring your food and comparing them to charts. So it's not exactly an easy diet for people to implement based on the number of everything you're supposed to be taking in. So it can and should be done, of course, with whole organic foods. But most of the time, it includes junk foods because people use it as an excuse to eat junk. So it was popularized by a social media post, food porn, indicating that you can eat junk food and have a well-sculpted body. Now, wouldn't that be the dream? But is a well-sculpted body the only measure of health? We have people coming to us because they have health issues, because they have hormone imbalances, because their gut's a mess, because of their neurotransmitters being out of balance, their hormones being out of balance. And so if you put them on a diet like this and they're still drinking Coke and eating M&Ms and just balancing it out with their fats and their proteins, then are you really helping them, right? Are you really helping them? So when we just focus on weight loss and the shape of the body, I think we're doing people a disservice. So these are the percentages. If somebody's going for weight loss, they go for high protein, low carb, low fat. Interesting, right? So it's different from ketogenic, very much different from ketogenic. None of these even comes close to resembling ketogenic, yet we know that ketogenic works really well in certain circumstances as well. So just more testament to the fact that you've got to find out what actually works for each person. So in the weight loss, they've got a person on 50%, up to 50% fat, 25 to 45 carb, and 20 to 35 fat. Now, when you look at something like ketogenic, just as a comparison, it's like 80% fat and maybe 10% of 15% protein, 5% carb. For maintenance, once you've reached your weight loss goals, then it's half carb pretty much and quarter of each protein and fat. And if you're looking for muscle gain, you're going for, and interestingly enough, you're going for less protein than the weight loss, which is what people, most people think that they should be eating more, but they're looking for muscle gain. I think they're looking at more carbs to fuel it. I don't know. I don't know where this came up, how they came up with these numbers, but this is what they're teaching. And then they have, you have to track everything. So they have some apps that you can do, and you plug things into the app and you get to see, you know, okay, I'm up to 30% protein and over here, so I've got to eat this much more of that in order to make the difference. Personally, I'm not a big fan of things. We have to be so strict about weighing and measuring because I don't think people stay there long term because it gets to be really very inconvenient. So what's the bad side of it? Well, Anything goes, sugar, flour, processed foods. You have to track calories and macros religiously to be successful. You have to adhere strictly to those macro percentages. And although they encourage people to eat whole, fresh, organic foods, it's not necessary. It's not mandatory. Probably a lot more protein when you look at those balances than is healthy for good kidney function, for bone function, because of the acidic waste products that the protein creates. There isn't much research to back it up, and it is used by competitors to enhance physique, but there really aren't any long-term studies. And my guess is that it's going to create long-term imbalances. And this is what I said before. The clients may look better, but they're not necessarily going to feel better. So the pros are there's no forbidden food, so people are psychologically happy with it. Some people don't mind measuring and weighing as long as they get to eat their favorite foods. It's easy to adhere to when traveling, so you don't have to find the gluten-free restaurant or the vegan restaurant or somebody that's not going to be putting a lot of sugar. It can be adapted to a clean eating program. So given the way it's put out there in this Pop-Tart mentality, it's really not very healthy, but it can be adapted if you wanted it to. And it can be done as vegan, vegetarian, any kind of plant-based. You can set the macros to match the goal the client wants to achieve. So looking at the chart, you look at it, and you know if that works, great. And if it doesn't, you can adapt it up or down until you find that and it works. I have never done this diet. I've just read about it, so it'd be interesting. I don't know anybody who has. Supposedly, when you do strength training with it, you can reach physique goals pretty quickly. And a lot of people are motivated by tracking. I would say to do this diet in a healthy way, you just don't want somebody to have health issues. It's really more for a healthy person who wants to lose weight or tone up as opposed to somebody who's sick, because you can create nutritional imbalances if all you're focusing on is the macronutrients. So that's it for the if it fits your macros. Let's take a look at some other diets that you might have heard of. There's Weight Watchers, Jenny Craig, Slim Fest. Those are all part of those programs that people can join. Weight Watchers, it's like you can pretty much eat what you want, but you have to hit their particular specifics of, it's pretty similar to the if it meets your macros in that regard. You have to have certain amounts of certain types of food, and you keep track of it calorie-wise and portion-wise and serving-wise. Jenny Craig and Slim Fest are more into these meal replacement type things. So these are really weight loss diets. They're not like practical diets that you're going to put somebody long term for health reasons. The Mediterranean diet and the DASH diet, on the other hand, are geared towards healthy diet for specific for cardiac and blood pressure. The DASH diet actually stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension. They are very similar. There's not a whole lot of differences. The DASH diet is very low sodium because we're dealing with people with hypertension. They're low fat, but not very low fat. So they include, in the DASH diet, they include mostly fish as the animal protein. They do both include a lot of breads and pastas and that sort of stuff. With the Mediterranean, the breads and the pastas are more at the bottom of the pyramid with lots and lots of veggies. I mean, really, really lots and lots of veggies. And with the Mediterranean diet, most people are looking at exercise, daily exercise, as being a very important part of this program. Okay, so those diets you may see, you may hear about, and adaptations of those diet can actually be very good for your particular client. And really what we're looking at is, how do you create that person's individual food pyramid? Finding which of the foods works best for that particular person. Personally, I like the fruit and vegetables at the bottom type diet. And I'm not a big fan of grains. I actually eliminate that part. So you have to find the one that works for people. If they do have a lot of lectins, they may be not tolerating grains at all. Sometimes people go gluten-free and they get results not because of getting rid of the gluten, but because of the starch component of the gluten, of the gluten-containing foods that they're not handling well. Other than fad diets, I think we've covered most of the major diets. I've been on lots and lots of fad diets. I've been on the grapefruit diet and the cabbage soup diet and the, you know, bagel and cream cheese diet and whatever else comes along. And the fad diets are really about creating a situation where you lose weight. Doesn't matter how you do it, you're feeling full and you lose weight, and that's basically it. So I lost 60 pounds on the Swiss cheese diet. So there's a lot of ways to get your weight down There's a lot of ways to turn people's health around. And your job as a practitioner is to help them to create that right balance that, number one, they can do. The best diet is not the one that gets the best results necessarily. It's the one that gets the best results that they're willing to do. If they're not willing to do it, all the great diets in the world are not going to help. So it's a matter of really helping people to outline what that best diet is for them. So here's a few references on the Eat Right for Your Type diet. Okay, so thank you for your attention, and we'll see you on the wrap-up.